Welcome to Buddha at the Gas Pump, our weekly discussion with people who have experienced or undergone a spiritual awakening. My name is Rick Archer, and my guest this week is Hillary Jordan. And I don't really have a bee in my bonnet this week about some topic that I want to do a monologue about at the beginning of this show. So I think we're going to get right into it. But I just one little point I wanted to make is that the idea of spiritual awakening as we define it on this show is not a set of beliefs or a conviction that one has kind of learned about or adopted in life, but rather a conscious discovery. The general definition, as most of my guests have brought it out, seems to be the conscious discovery, consciousness or pure awareness as one's essential nature. And as you may have noticed, if you've been watching this show, everyone seems to experience that and express their experience in unique ways. And I think that's good and interesting. And as a matter of fact, as one of my guests pointed out, it almost might be a criterion for genuine spiritual awakening that you're using your own words to describe it and not just repeating something you've heard somebody say. I guess I did have a little monologue, but that's it. Again, my guest this week is Hillary Jordan. And Hillary, why don't we start out by just having you give us a little bit of biographical information about yourself, you know, what you do, where you're from, that kind of thing.
I was born in California, and I came here 5 years ago for MUM.
And here meaning Fairfield, Iowa, and yeah, MUM Fairfield, meaning Iowa. Marshy University mm-hmm. of Management.
Yeah. I went to MUM for 3 years, and I got another BA and a master's degree, and then I went and was on the Invincible America course for a couple years.
Invincible, define that.
The Invincible America course is part of the Transcendental Meditation Movement, and we all meditate together in the dome for quite a few hours a day.
And the dome is a couple of big domes that have been built on campus for the people to meditate together.
Meditate together, and I was actually on that for a year, and mm-hmm. then I went to massage school, and I've been teaching dance for 2 years here, and I work at the Raj right now, which is another place where we do Panchakarma, which is an Ayurvedic technique of massage and purification. So it's something that's also part of the Transcendental Meditation Movement. But I actually also studied Ayurveda in California, at California College of Ayurveda, and I've done a lot of holistic health training, and I'm trying to get my massage license right now and just do massage out of my house. I just really like Fairfield, so that's why I'm here still.
Hmm. What BA and MA did you get?
I got two BAs, actually. I got a BA in a special major, which was dance, psychology, holistic health, and theater at San Francisco State in 2001. Mm-hmm. And then I went to California College of Ayurveda. And then I worked with emotionally disturbed children, actually, in mental health for a couple years in California. And I went to MUM then and got a second BA in physiology and health. And then I got a master's degree in Vedic science, which is the science of consciousness. And then after that, I was on the Invincible America course and did some
lots of meditating.
Like that. Yeah.
Yeah. And these days you teach dance.
Yes.
And you do massages.
I do massages, and I work at the Raj right now.
Panchakarma, which is part of Ayurveda, and those are the three main things you do, right?
Yeah, I'd like to expand eventually and do more, you know, holistic health type counseling, and mm-hmm. I'm really into herbs and all that kind of thing. So cool. I've developed my own energy work, so I do that too now. And
what do you do? What's that? What do you do with that?
There's a lot of different forms of energy work, and I've studied only basic Reiki and cranial sacral and things like that, but it's really not my own form of energy work isn't really like those. I kind of just found that I had a talent for kind of creating an atmosphere for somebody when I was massaging people, because I've massaged people for a good amount of years, because I went to massage school in California also. I missed that part.
You mentioned that.
I trained to be a Panchakarma tech actually in California, so I ended up having to go to massage school. I think I'm just really attracted to the magical side of life, and so I kind of figured out how to focus a certain kind of energy on somebody. It's pretty subtle. It's not something that people always know that's happening to them or not, but I've gotten some pretty good results. People tend to have some noticeable qualities happen.
Okay. So you described to us what we might call the objective side of your life, the things that people could observe, the activities and the education,
right,
and so on. So now let's shift to the subjective and try to, you know, maybe you could give us a rundown on your history with that and touching upon the most significant milestones leading up to the present.
Okay, so my history with the subjective?
Well, that's always interesting, isn't it? it's more abstract.
Yeah, it kind of starts for everybody in childhood, right? So I guess I wasn't really particularly different than anyone in childhood. I think I definitely had a thing where I would go into my room and dance for an invisible audience.
You and Michael Jackson.
Me and Michael Jackson. And my boyfriend has pointed out that he thinks that I actually had some feeling for other beings in other realms or something, that I was like dancing for my own little angels or
something.
So I like to think of it that way. Mm-hmm. I feel like I've been going more into that realm of the imagination land when you're a kid. Mm-hmm. I think that's actually real, and people just pretend when they get older that it's not. And so we tell ourselves that like this is all that's real, like this table in front of me or anything that we can see is all that's real, and it's not really true. So trying to explore, you know, other realms and stuff. But
so you were a child and you dance, and then normal teenage life?
I was a horrible teenager. I gave my parents a really hard time.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
Just found out that in Human Design that I'm a projector, so that means that I take in all of everything that everybody gives me and then multiply it and give it back to them. So I really gave it to my family pretty good. They're just now getting over it. But I created my own dance company in high school. So I was very outward, you know, once I got older. My family taught me that...
Your parents were meditators, weren't they?
My parents were meditators until I was 3. Mm-hmm. So when I was conceived and for my first 3 years, they were meditators. Mm-hmm. And they stopped when my sister was born.
Mm-hmm. Just got too busy or something?
If Leslie ever watches this, I'm sorry, but it's true. Mm-hmm. she was a crazy kid. She knows this. Like, she was just too much, I think, for them to meditate. Uh-huh. But it's just they didn't feel drawn to it anymore. You know, my dad meditates on planes sometimes still. Right. So
And so when did you first kind of get interested in explicitly spiritual type things? You know, it suddenly dawned on you that you wanted to meditate or pursue that sort of thing.
What I've traced back is that my first kind of bad memories are from when my parents stopped meditating. Mm-hmm. That's what I remember is that when I was about 3 or so, or somewhere around there, shortly before we moved, there was a really bad feeling, and I got all these phobias, and I was really scared of spiders and bees, and the kids across the street were scaring me.
You
and
think that had anything to do with your parents stopping meditating?
It just felt, I feel like it did. Because it felt less comfortable, and I'm very sensitive energetically to atmosphere, and that's something that I've been trying to deny my whole life, but it's just not, it's just true, you know, so I actually take in what is around me.
So the atmosphere they were creating was a little less coherent.
Yeah, but you know, I was bound to have my own, I was bound to have my own fears and everything anyway, but I do think that has something to do with it. And we moved, and I was like a crazy, like phobic kid for a little while. But I had a lot of fun, and I bossed other kids around and stuff, so, you know. We have some chemical, emotional stuff in our family, and I had a really hard time when I was a teenager. I know most people tend towards that anyway, but I just knew that there was something more to life than just what's going on the outside all the time. And I was taught that it's just this, it's just what we see and everything, and it's all... that life is very outward, and I created my own dance company in high school, which was still one of the coolest experiences of my life. But I was extremely emotionally disturbed the whole time, so had a really hard time, didn't get along with people very well, and found a boy who was a meditator. So I ended up, my first boyfriend was a meditator, and his whole family meditated. I actually asked my dad at dinner some night, I asked my dad if he, I said something about how my boyfriend was a meditator, that his family did that, and my dad said, "Oh, what kind of meditation does he do?" And so
it was TM.
It was TM. Mm-hmm. So it was all very synchronous, mm-hmm.
So did your, was your dad a teacher? Did he teach you or somebody else?
No, no. It was back in the 70s when they learned, and there weren't so many teachers, and I think he was going to be a checker or something. Right.
So then you learned to meditate, and how old were you then?
I learned to meditate, but not until I was 19.
Okay.
Yeah. I first went to UC Santa Cruz and had a nervous breakdown and had to come home. Mm-hmm. I just couldn't deal with the fact that I didn't have a dance company anymore. And so then my dad came. He was very nice. He came and picked me up and was like, okay, let's take you home. And I told him that I was interested in learning to meditate because I had already gotten some guy from the TM movement to come to UC Santa Cruz and give us introductory lectures and preparatory lectures and all that stuff. And I was still the only person interested, I think. Yeah. Like, there were a lot of people interested until they learned about the money part, and then they were like, that's it, you know. So my dad was really, really sweet and paid for me to meditate. So then I started meditating, and I went to San Francisco State, and I got all into the holistic health program there, which is really cool.
So did your personality change much when you learned to meditate?
Yeah. A lot smoother. My mom noticed, I think everybody, my sister especially, noticed right away that I was different. And I remember my mom saying before I learned to meditate that I needed to see a counselor and that I had an artistic personality.
Euphemism.
Yeah. And then I learned to meditate and things were starting to smooth out and she stopped. She didn't say anything about it after that. So.
Right. When you learn to meditate, aside from your behavior and emotional state smoothing out, did you have any particularly noteworthy inner experiences that...
Well, my first meditation was really pretty amazing because I remember closing my eyes and this light coming down from on top of me, kind of, and it felt like leaves falling from trees, only they were made of light.
Hmm. Kind of like those things in Avatar.
It was very peaceful, and I do think about that because I think that first meditation has something to do with the person, and it's very prophetic, you know, and people end up thinking about that again. Definitely after that, I just slept a whole bunch and unstressed, as we call it, de-stressing, you know, the process of becoming cranky and then blaming it on meditation.
And so fast forwarding a little bit, you know, now you say that you have undergone a spiritual awakening or whatever terminology we want to use. What brought that about? How long were you meditating before that happened?
I was meditating for about 10 or 11 years. Mm-hmm. This only happened, I'm very much a baby in this sense. This only happened like the August before last, so a year and a half ago.
Okay, and now it's January of 2010, so about a year and a half. So it happened August of 2008.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm actually not sure now if it had happened before that and I just wasn't totally sure. Mm-hmm. There was something very mild that happened at first and then I had this dramatic thing happen in August a year and a half ago. So the very mild thing that I noticed was that I would wake up and I would realize that it wasn't really that different being awake than being asleep. And I just remember feeling a little bit lighter and a little bit happier. In August of that year, I was in the dome and I had a big hoorah kind of
so experience. So you're doing your usual meditation thing in the dome and ho-hum, same day as, you know, same as any other day, but all of a sudden, kablam.
Yeah, well, interestingly, I had stopped meditating very much. Mm-hmm. I had just gone to a very small program to go to massage school.
Mm-hmm. Small programming, you're doing short.
Just short meditations. Yeah. And the thing was that I had started working seriously on my emotions and really feeling what was present, and then
just in your own way, or did you go through some kind of technique?
My boyfriend Dan helped me. I started doing that like 2.5 years ago, and I would just kind of feel what was there, really like look at my actions and my feelings and see what the common thread is, because usually there's like a theme that's happening at any given time and everything's going to that. It's kind of like you could call it a lesson or something along those lines, but it's just this theme that's coming up that is something, it's the next thing to let go of, basically.
So you kind of pay more attention to what you're going through emotionally and stuff, and that was kind of help. I don't mean to put words in your mouth, but I'm just, and so that sort of helped to work some things out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because what had happened actually was that I was doing really long programs in the Dome on the Invincible America course, and I was
long just, programs meaning you were doing long meditation periods.
Right. Okay. Right. I was doing long periods of meditation. And I always exercise and everything, so I wasn't having a lot of the problems with meditating for a long. I can meditate forever. That's never been a problem for me. I like meditating a lot. But I think that's always because it's been balanced by dancing and exercise, too. I just felt like I wasn't going anywhere fast. Mm. And then I also had a pattern where I would get out of the Dome, and at a certain point after I would get out of the Dome, I would just freak out, just you know, and it's what we call stressing usually. We're just supposed to not pay attention to it and just let it go, you know.
You mean like several hours after leaving the Dome or something, you mean, when you say get out of the Dome? Or?
Being on the Invincible America course is intense for most people, and there's a lot of unstressing, emotional unstressing that happens. Yeah.
How many hours a day do people meditate on this Invincible America course?
Or it's
not,
like,
not just meditation, but the whole package?
About 6 hours a day, I think.
Yeah.
You know.
And some people are doing this for months or even years on end.
Yeah. And I did it for 2 years, actually, because part of my master's was doing that, too.
2 years solid?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's quite a bit.
I mean, I took a break to go home and stuff, you know. I just felt like I was sitting there and I was getting rest and I was maintaining and I was, you know, I was growing, but I didn't feel like I was growing as fast as I wanted to. Mm-hmm. I would always have these emotional problems when I wasn't in the Dome because there's
volatile,
so much unstressing.
Getting
volatile,
angry and crying.
Angry,
and
upset, sad, you name it.
All
like
kinds
any,
of stuff.
You know, anxious, fearful. And I kind of knew that it was a little extreme. And I was reading, when I was on my master's, I was reading Sanskrit also, which is another purification technique. So I was like ready to go drink a bottle of whiskey sometimes, like seriously. When I met Dan, I knew that I wanted to work more on what was actually going on emotionally with me. I'd already known him for a while. I didn't just meet him. When I got together with him, he helped me do that kind of stuff. He was always helping me, actually, even when I was his friend before that. But you can only go so long associating all of your emotions with what is actually going on in your relative life. Mm. Those things that are happening in your relative life are not connected. It's like we're just keeping ourselves in a loop. And a loop by always associating our emotions with what's happening to us in the outside world, because what's happening to us in the outside world isn't actually real compared to what's happening in the inside. You know, it's like we're manifesting in the outside world what's inside of us. And so
that's an important point. I think it might bear a little discussion. I mean, I guess what you're saying is usually people, I'm mad at this person. I'm upset about that thing. I'm upset with the government. I'm upset with my husband. I'm upset with my financial situation or you know, not only negative things like upset, maybe, oh, I really love this person and I, you know, I need to be with this person, or I'm jealous because I'm not with this person and so-and-so is. All these emotions are all kind of defined by external circumstances. And what you're saying is it's not so much the, correct me if I'm wrong, it's not so much the external circumstances which are causing the emotions, it's the emotional stuff coming up, finding something that to attach itself to, because it doesn't want to just have doesn't want to exist in the abstract. It wants to justify its existence by latching onto something.
Yeah, totally.
And so what you're saying is you kind of broke out of that blind attachment to external circumstances as the cause of what you're going through and began to kind of look inward a little bit and discover that it wasn't so much the circumstance as the thing itself, the emotion you're feeling that needed to be dealt with.
Yeah. Okay. Exactly. That's right. And it's one of those things that it takes forever to actually master this.
Yeah.
It's a whole technique in itself.
It's like riding a bicycle. You can never stop balancing.
Yeah. I mean, you're going along and something happens to you. You feel like something's happened to you, but really it hasn't happened to you. It's something that you're doing inside of yourself. Mm-hmm. And it's so easy to just react to the outside world, you know.
Long-established habit.
Yeah, it's just that this is all not as real as what we think it is. So
we're back in sort of approaching August 2008, and you had been kind of dealing with or looking at emotions and working a lot of stuff out with the help of Dan, your boyfriend, who we're going to get on the show sooner or later. And then, you know, lead us up to this Lollapalooza event.
And that's so fitting because I did go to Lollapalooza like 3 times when I was a teenager.
What is Lollapalooza?
Lollapalooza is a fabulous festival of grunge rock back
in the
90s.
Oh, I didn't even know that.
Oh, see? But the cameraman knows it.
Okay.
I went to the one with Beastie Boys. I went to the one with, you know, the Smashing Pumpkins. Huh. Anyway. I was in the dome and I was doing our yogic flying technique, which looks more like hopping around in a little circle. I think what happens is that you grow up to a point and then you have to surrender. This is what I'm learning, is that there's a point where you're ready and you have to just surrender and let go of something, and then something really cool happens. That's a faster way in some ways of evolving, is the surrender, I think. But I don't know, that was my experience. I just sat there and I think I was having a bunch of issues about energy. I was in massage school, and I was trying not to take on other people's energy.
There in the dome?
In massage, actually.
Oh, in massage.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I would be in massage, and then I would get out of massage, and I would feel kind of depleted. Yeah. And so there was something, and I think that I'm giving Dan so much credit here. I think
he's an awesome guy.
Dan's
We're just building suspense,
awesome guy,
you know, for the Dan interview.
he said it's all your energy, and it's true. Yeah. And I think that really clicked something for me, and I just surrendered, like, I don't care anymore, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's really what it comes down to most of the time, is like, I just don't care anymore. It doesn't have to be a certain way. I'm not going to be attached to it.
Not insisting that things happen any particular way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or loving what is, as Byron Katie would put it.
Yeah.
So you're there in the dome, hopping around, and right then and there you had this shift in attitude of don't care anymore? Is that what you're saying?
I said, you know what? I said something to God, like, I surrender. I don't care anymore. You know, it's okay. Whatever.
Uh-huh.
Whatever's got to happen. I'm just too tired to keep being
struggling.
Attached and struggling and having other people's energy or my energy or whatever. It was just like too much identification of things, you know.
And so what happened?
I just had this, if I remember correctly, it was like pink waves of bliss, and I saw a lot of things happen.
Okay.
I actually saw Maharshi and Gurudev then, which is interesting to me because even though I greatly appreciate them, they're not really part of my path anymore.
Right.
But I think I was giving thanks or something to the opportunity I had. And so I saw, you know, a lot of celestial visions, like gold and pink and lotuses and gurus and, you know, like,
kind of stuff.
And there was ocean waves going on. And I think I opened my eyes and saw people's faces looking like gold. Mm. That's happened to me a few times in the dome. And all of a sudden my physiology changed. And that's the important thing to me, is like when it's really solid and physical and you can feel it.
How did it change?
Huge weight lifted, and just felt like my whole body was lighter and healthier. It had more energy, and I just felt more unbounded.
And it never went back?
It never went away. I kept thinking it might go away.
Yeah.
Like, I went and I talked to my friend and I walked around with him, and I was like thinking to myself, it's still here.
Yeah.
You know, but I didn't want to talk to you about it because I don't want to, you know, disturb anyone about what's going on in terms of my state of consciousness. Usually, you know, it's like some people really find it disturbing.
So far you've defined that experience in terms of things you were seeing, like celestial stuff and everything, and a change that you felt occur in your physiology.
Yeah.
Is there more to it?
I just remember taking my pulse and it felt completely different. You know, I learned how to take pulse in Ayurveda class. It's a technique of this Indian holistic health that I learned, and what we would call OGIS was there everywhere now, and it was clearer, and it was... OGIS is strength, like a strength of your immune system, and it's just a clarity and a strength to your physiology in general. Mm-hmm. So, and there's a gentleness there too, like things aren't so rough for you. So that was there, and it was just completely different. It was like taking the pulse of a dead person before and then taking the pulse of someone alive. That's how it felt to me.
Hmm.
And I had other people do it just to see, you know, if it was
really
real.
Like, when you read people's pulse or your own pulse, do you pick up a lot of information?
Yeah, there's a lot of information. There's tons and tons of information there, and I don't feel even like I don't gather all of it when I take somebody's pulse, but I usually just get an intuition mm-hmm. about something when I'm taking somebody's pulse, and it's usually the thing that is important for them at that time or something. Right. It's not normally like everything that's going on in their entire body. That's not how I work, apparently. But there are vagists who can take your mm-hmm. pulse and tell you everything about you if you have enough time.
I've been with them.
Money and, yeah.
Yeah, there was this guy in India that was amazing. But in any case, the reason I asked you that about, you know, the fact that you defined your experience so far in terms of perceptual things and in terms of physiological changes is that most people, when they talk about spiritual awakenings, don't mention those things so much. They talk more about self-realization or some kind of realization of who they really are as consciousness, that mm-hmm. kind of terminology.
Yeah.
Was that there too, or what?
Well, actually, I do want to say that I think in other movements, in the TM movement, there's a very hierarchical structure of cosmic consciousness, God consciousness, unity consciousness, Brahman consciousness,
and these are stages
you go through one at a time. Mm-hmm. And in other movements, like I've been reading Adyashanti's books lately, they don't consider that you've woken up until you would be in what Maharshi would consider Brahman consciousness. So,
which is?
That's when you're really not deluded anymore, ever, by the relative world. It's like you always know that your real self is everything, that you are everything, you are the universe, you are God, everything.
Experientially, right?
Yeah, experientially. And I do feel like I'm getting very close to that, but mm-hmm. but I think in Maharshi's terminology, it would still be in between mm-hmm. unity and Brahman.
Well, so when you look at things, do they look like things, or do you see them all in some other sense that you think that maybe people in general don't see the world around them?
They look like things to me, just like they look like to everybody else. But there's a little bit more of a transparency now mm-hmm. than there used to be. I'm not as sure that they're so solid anymore as mm-hmm. they used to be. I'm not as sure sometimes that I can't like even put my hand through something. You know,
right.
I mean, it's not really that dramatic all the time. You just go about and you live mm-hmm. your life, and it's not that different. There's these inner changes happening. Like when I close my eyes, it's a lot different than it used to be when I close my eyes.
Yeah.
So that's definitely something that you can't miss. I mean,
now some people say that prior to their awakening, I don't mean to lead the witness, so to speak, but some people say that prior to their awakening, they understood or perceived themselves to be merely this flesh encased entity, which was born, which is living, which will die, which is here and not there.
Yeah.
And after their awakening, they said, okay, well, I am that.
Mm-hmm.
I am a human being, obviously, but I'm also something else.
Yeah.
And the two coexist quite comfortably.
Yeah.
Can you concur with that? Or is that?
I didn't quite have that uh-huh. same sense of unboundedness when I first woke up.
Uh-huh.
But now it's a little bit, it's not all the way integrated, mm-hmm. but I do feel like I'm not just this anymore. It's right. It's like, especially if I close my eyes, I actually feel like I'm God.
Huh. What does he feel like?
Yeah, actually, for me, it feels better to say goddess for mm-hmm. some reason, but that's just my own personality, I think. And if I put attention on it, I always feel like I'm the goddess or like I'm the universe mm-hmm. and like I'm everything that
exists.
Is
that what you mean by? I mean, some people hear somebody say, I feel like I'm God, and I'm like, whoa.
I know. That's why I kind of laughed. Better elaborate
on what you mean by that.
I really don't want people like just getting that sound bite, you know, yeah. from this. It's just that everybody is the same thing.
Right.
You know, and it's really that simple in a lot of ways. I mean, you can use a bunch of flowery language to describe it, but mm-hmm. it's just that there's this one thing, and I am that, even though you are also that, and mm-hmm. so is everything else.
So when you say you feel like I am God or I am goddess, you are referring to, and again, I don't mean to put words in your mouth, but you're referring to your status as something larger, something more universal, something deeper, or...
Yeah.
Is that what?
But you know, when you use those words, I think people can get caught in like what's the actual solid physical kind of experience of that? I mean, like, I really like to emphasize that for me it's just a physical thing. Like I close my eyes and there's the center of the universe in front of me.
Mm-hmm.
And I only know that's the center of the universe because it doesn't make sense that it's anything else, really.
Well, wait a minute. How can this, if the center of the universe is in front of you, Then are you a little bit off-center?
Well, it's kind of like right where my heart would be. Ah. It's like, and for some reason, that's a little bit out here right now. Huh. But, you know, to each his own. I think it's just, it could be just a stage.
And is there really that much of a difference between having your eyes open and closing your eyes in terms of this experience?
Well, I think that it's just that what happens to me when my eyes are closed is mm-hmm. the same as when they're open, but I'm just not experiencing it as much when my eyes are open right now because I'm still living in this dream state, so to speak, where everybody's just
attending to it as
separate
as closely or something.
Yeah, it's like my attention isn't as on it, you know, yet. And I think that it's going to be pretty dramatic, actually, in my everyday life once it integrates fully, or I don't know how else to say it, but...
Actually, I would suggest that it probably won't be dramatic when it integrates fully.
Well, that's true. Maybe.
Kind of ordinary.
Yeah, when it integrates fully, it'll probably just be like, no big deal.
How about when you're dancing? What do you notice then? And how did this awakening that happened in August of 2008 affect your dancing?
That's a good question, actually. What I've noticed when I'm dancing, especially lately, is just that I have so much more bliss than I used to. Mm-hmm. And I'm not a airy-fairy blissful kind of person all the time. It's not like I'm searching for bliss, which I really appreciate, but it's not something that I want truth is what I want. If bliss is a side effect, then that's cool. And I totally am getting that side effect, especially when I dance lately. Mm-hmm. And then just my dancing got a lot better mm-hmm. in general. I think I just feel more confident because there's less going on that's hindering me now.
Yeah.
And it's almost, you can almost explain it psychologically in a lot of ways because there's less issues keeping me from being confident or keeping me from being able to get a step or do something because I don't have this idea in my head that I can't do it or that there's something in the way of being able to do it. So
feel more liberated or something.
Yeah, I just feel like whatever it is, I can probably figure it out, at least in the area of dance because I've been doing it my whole life. You know, the other areas of my life are a little bit slower to get to that point, I think.
Do you ever get like really tired or maybe get the flu or something and get to the point where you feel like, I'm just the same old schmo as I ever was, you know?
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah, and I don't feel like my body's never going to get, like there's going to be a point where I'm never going to get sick or something,
right.
You know, and be like this magical person who flies around or something. But I have noticed that whether I get enough sleep or not affects me less now, mm-hmm. and I can just kind of function, if I have to, on a lot less than I was able to before. And I've noticed that if I get sick, I'm not as upset about it. I don't have as many feelings and attachments to what's going on the outside. So I just kind of know, oh, that's what's happening right now mm-hmm. a lot of the time now. It's not fun.
And it's not like, I don't get the impression that you've gotten good at adopting an attitude of acceptance. It's more like, you know, you shifted in a way that has enabled you to be more accepting. Something changed.
Yeah.
And kind of spontaneously, you are more flowing, more accepting, more frictionless.
Yeah. And the thing about it is that it's gradual. You know, it progresses all the time. When I first woke up, I mean, it was amazing physically, but then I still have gotten sick quite a few times and mm-hmm. it's been horrible, you know. But I've noticed that it's getting easier. Just life in general is getting easier as it goes on. Yeah, so there's just like a feeling of less and less, you know, difficulty. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I still go through these cycles where there's a new issue. There's mm-hmm. a new something that needs to be paid attention to.
My sense of things, you know, from my experience and talking to people and reading things and everything else is that, you know, for most people at least, there are degrees of awakening. There are multiple awakenings. Even Adyashanti, whom you mentioned, who is a you know very popular spiritual teacher these days, he had a big awakening when he was 25.
Mm-hmm.
And then he went through all kinds of stuff.
And
then when he was about 33, he had another one, which is much more profound and
complete.
And that's not to say that there only needs to be two major ones for anybody. I think it just comes in as many flavors as there are people. And some people seem to have these real dramatic abrupt shifts, you know, where they it's a night and day difference all of a sudden, and others it seems to be gradual and mm-hmm. almost imperceptible. And
it's kind of a combination of both, too, sometimes. Because I keep thinking that I'm going to fit into a set system or some philosophy or there's going to be a hierarchy where I can find myself. And I can usually figure out something when I look at that stuff with my mind, you know, and try to fit myself into a hierarchy. It's just not really totally linear like that. Things don't go like that. And I've accepted that it's not. And I've noticed that there's an awakening and then there's another one, and that doesn't necessarily mean you're in a certain state of consciousness yet, and then there's another one, and then there's another one, you know, it just keeps going on and on, kind of. And so I've had a lot of them.
Yeah.
But
every time I come here every week, you know, my wife asks me, who are you going to interview this week? And I say, so-and-so. And they say, is she awake? Is he awake? At first she was saying it like, oh, so they think they're enlightened? And I say, no, not exactly, you know? But I kind of kept insisting on using the terminology carefully, and now she sort of got it, and she says, oh, so they feel like they've had an awakening? And I said, yeah, they do.
That's great.
My sense of that, and the reason I try to be careful about the terminology, is that I'm willing to be corrected if I'm wrong, but that there's no sense of finality to that. I mean, maybe there are sort of there is some sort of final awakening that a person can have, and they're going to say, that's it. There's nothing more that's going to unfold for me. But so far, none of the people I've interviewed feel that. Although one thing that has come out with some of the people is that, you know, as far as consciousness is concerned, that doesn't seem to develop any. It in and of itself is not something which gets bigger or anything else. But what does develop is our ability to reflect it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the clarity with which we appreciate it. You know, there may be no end to that.
Mm-hmm.
I think it might have even been my guest last week who said, on the one hand, no, nothing changes. There are no further developments. On the other hand, everything's constantly changing and developing.
Yeah, and I don't actually, you know, I have my own personality, and my personality believes that there is no end to evolution, you know, because I don't see anything around me just stopping.
Yeah.
That does seem to be something that I can attach myself to. No, I'm kidding. I just see that everybody, even when they might think that they've had a final awakening, seems like they keep growing to me, you know, and that's really cool, I think, because I don't ever want to stop growing. I think it would be boring.
Yeah.
I think there is a more complete awakening as somebody like Adyashanti or a bunch of these people who've written books. I think they would say that there's like an initial one, like he says, and then a more complete one. And I do feel like I'm rounding over the complete one kind of pretty soon, because I have such dramatic things happen, you know, at night or like when I close my eyes, but it hasn't all bled into the rest of my, you know, everyday waking life yet.
I think it's important for people to realize that it comes in so many different flavors, because I've seen it happen, and I've done this myself at times in my life, that you sort of get what you feel is a clear understanding of how things are supposed to unfold, or you hear somebody else talking about their experiences, and if your experience doesn't conform to that, and you think, well, I'm really nowhere, you know, that they have such good experiences. And you got to sort of realize that yours is yours. You know?
Yeah.
And it's going to be different for every person.
Yeah. It took me a long time to get that, because I was part of the TM movement. And whenever you're part of a movement, there's so much
doctrine.
Yeah, there's so much doctrine to believe in and to think that you have to fit yourself
into.
Like,
you have this, then you have this. Yeah,
yeah, like that this is going to happen to you, and then this is going to happen to you. And that's kind of comforting in a way, because you can just sit back and wait for those things to happen to you. And that's what I was doing for a while. You know, I was like, it's okay. I don't need to be there right now, but I just know that it's going to happen because so-and-so said so. You know,
well, there are people in this town who've been waiting for those things to happen to them for 40 years now. I would argue that in many cases, those things have happened to them, but what has happened doesn't conform to their conception of what was supposed to happen.
Yeah.
And so they're kind of looking for something that they've actually already found, not realizing that their conception of it, you know, is different than the actuality of it.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons why I wanted to do this interview with you, is because I feel like that it's a little bit sad for everybody to sit around and want something that they're not allowing themselves to have, kind of, even though they don't know they're not allowing themselves to have it. It's really not as extraordinary, I don't think, anymore. Mm. I think it's going to start being pretty commonplace pretty soon, because I feel like the world is changing a lot, and I feel like it's just a feeling of being that's there with you all the time. Mm-hmm. And when people recognize that, then everything else just builds on that. That's like a foundation, you know, for really living in reality instead of in the state of like misery, kind of, you know. I mean, yeah. Living in the relative where all of these things in front of us are so real that we have to conform to them and that we have to fit into them, and it's so sad. Like it just hurts. And I think there was a point that you said before that I think is important, and that is that I think a lot of people think that they're going to become something more. There is a sense of expanding, but that comes from letting go, you know? And that's the only thing that I know for sure in a lot of this, is that I'm just letting go of more and more things that were keeping me boxed into a small space and where I was thinking that I was very small. When you let go of those barriers, you start feeling bigger and bigger. Mm-hmm. And you realize that you were always big the whole time and you just didn't know. I think it's really just about, for me at least, it's just about letting go. It's just about letting go of what's in the way of feeling all of that all the time. And it's a hard process in some ways because those emotional things are most of the time what are standing in the way, you know?
It seems like sometimes letting go is a combination of both volition and a kind of a force that's making it happen anyway. And the volition part is to what extent we want to cooperate with the process as opposed to struggle with it or resist it.
I think that's very well said. Yeah. Because I was thinking that today, how much of it is under my control? I mean, in a certain sense, nothing's under my control, you know?
Right.
And in another sense, everything's under my control. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because if from the small me, Hillary self, there's nothing really that's under my control. Because the universe is just doing its thing mm-hmm. all the time, and I'm just a part of it, you know? And from the big sense of the goddess or the universe or the big self or all these terms that you want it, there's so many mm-hmm. different names for it, you know? Then everything is under my control in that sense.
You do have a sense of that big self. That's what I was kind of getting at earlier. It wasn't just a matter of some pink perceptions and some relaxation of your body.
Oh.
There's a sense of a larger self and an individual self. And, and there's sort of paradoxes that we could talk about, but the paradoxes all kind of resolve themselves happily.
Mm-hmm. It started out, though, just being a letting go and a physical change. It started out being more of a more emotional wholeness, more physical wholeness and energy and all those things. And that's all it really felt like. I mean, it wasn't like I thought I was a different person or anything like that, you know, at first. And now I'm just more and more aware as I go on that I'm not this body is all, that I'm everything and that...
And I might add that, you know, you are this body and you have a very sort of adroit body. You're a dancer, your body, you haven't lost any bodily skills.
No, it's not like I'm
saying that because
I'm not walking around going... Right. Where is my body?
Well, I'm kind of anticipating skeptics' questions who might feel that, you know, you're going to become, as you said earlier, airy-fairy or kind of like become emaciated because you're so... And I've actually met people and know people...
Yeah, that stop eating.
Yeah, they stop eating. They had to be hospitalized because they said, I'm so spiritual, you know, I don't want to do anything so gross as eat.
Yeah. But that's the thing about this whole thing that I've realized is that it has to be integrated physically. That's what... Maharshi and a bunch of saints and gurus always said is it has to be integrated physically. But the interesting thing to me was that I thought I was going to just, it was going to happen to me physically, mm-hmm. that I was just going to physically wake up one day and feel different. And that didn't happen, actually.
Well, it sort of did in the dome.
Well, what happened was I decided to let go of an emotional thing that was in my way. And that is what...
You think you really decided that day in August of 08? Was it a decision or did it seem like a decision and it was something that was just ready to happen?
You could say it both ways, I think, because
of course
everything's supposed to happen, however.
The same thing or maybe not?
Probably not. I mean, everything happens the way it's supposed to happen when it's supposed, I mean, it's like, it's all going to happen the way it's happening, right? But I think that there was a push that I gave myself for sure. Mm-hmm. And I think that was being willing to confront what is there mm-hmm. and not be avoiding it or be attached to something else. Mm. It's just like that, like willingness to just be there with the truth. And
it does seem like the fact that you, and I've seen this in other people too, the fact that you put a little bit of conscious attention on working some things out and tending to things that you had been ignoring and so on, and you had a friend who was helping you do this and all, that seems to have had a powerful effect.
Yeah, I definitely would not be, I would not be experiencing any of this if I hadn't done that. And I'm not saying that it wasn't supposed to happen that way anyway, but I wouldn't be here right now. I would still be doing 6 hours of meditation a day. Seriously, I don't meditate, you know, more than a half hour a day right now. I feel the same whether I meditate or not now. Mm-hmm. Which is another thing that I think is good for people to understand, because you can see how it's kind of, meditation feels physical in a lot of ways. You can feel a difference when you meditate, like when you sleep or when you eat or when you exercise.
You get addicted to it.
Yeah, and so it's good to note that there's a difference now when I sleep or when I meditate, because it is a physical difference. But for me, it was by confronting my emotions that I got here, because I had too many emotions standing in the way of what is the truth, which is that I am everything and there's no real limits. There's no boundaries, you know.
About 10 minutes ago, you said something about a lot of dramatic experiences still going on or something. Remember that?
The other night I was thinking about, there's a whole worry situation in my family, right, where we worry forever and it goes back many generations, you know, among the women of my family. And I think people can relate to this generally, because most people have some anxiety, some nervousness, worry, fear, something. Fear is one of those like really basic emotions that everybody, you know. And I remember just thinking, I was lying in bed, I was just thinking about all the things I had to do the next day and my whole schedule and how I was totally packed with things. And should I worry about this? I mean, I was worrying about my cat just went outside and he's going to get stuck outside in the cold or something. And I was just like, I don't want to worry about this anymore. It's like I'm making a conscious decision that I don't want this anymore. And when you have a desire and you put attention on it and you do kind of make a decision in that sense, I think it does really prompt the goddess or God or the universe to help you.
That's kind of interesting, you know, because of that great popularity of The Secret a while back where, oh, I desire this diamond necklace and it's going to come to me, or I desire this car, or I desire this big, beautiful house. And there was a lot of emphasis on material things in that movie. And personally, and I think you would agree, a much more effective and perhaps fulfillable way of applying that principle is in terms of what you're saying, just sort of putting attention on these inner attachments and so on, and emotions and whatnot that are binding us, and thereby facilitating their release or resolution.
Yeah, and what I've noticed is that The Secret doesn't work for a lot of people because they are expecting that if they desire things and they think positively, that does the whole job. And it's totally right way to start. But what I've noticed is that when you desire something, what comes up, what you start to feel is what's in the way of getting that. Because that's what you're supposed to put your attention on next. Because it's like the universe gives you everything you need, you know, very simply, if we know how to pay attention to it. You know, it's like,
that's interesting. So you're saying that if you have a desire, even for something material, I want a such and such, then the universe or God or whatever is going to say, okay, you want that? Well, here's what you're going to have to do first.
Exactly.
You're going to have to work this out and that out.
Yeah, totally. When I was the other night, when I was lying in bed and I was like, I don't want to worry anymore. I just don't want to worry anymore. Because it's one of those insidious things. I don't even realize how much I do it. It just permeates all of my family, my culture in general, I think, you know. But
not Jewish, are you?
No.
I guess that's
Irish.
That's guilt. Okay.
Yeah, it is my Irish ancestors who worried a lot. But I think it's a pretty normal thing. And what comes up is all those feelings of binding myself, the fear that there might not be, that something might be wrong, you know, or whatever it is. It's like it'll come up and you'll feel it. And by avoiding that, it actually makes it harder to get to where you're trying to go. And when I feel my feelings is when I get these amazing breakthroughs, like these feelings of, you know, more awakenings. And when I did that the other night, I said, I guess I was in a point where I could do this, but I said, I choose the goddess instead of that. I just kept saying, I choose a goddess. And then I got all sorts of amazing emptiness and lightness filled my body. And it hasn't gone away. It's still there, but it's integrating a little bit, I think.
Johnny Gray, you know, who wrote the book Mars, Venus, Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus.
Yeah.
He's an old friend of mine, actually. One of his earlier books was called What You Feel, or What You Can Feel, You Can Heal.
Uh-huh.
And
that's it.
I never actually, I don't know if I read the book or not. I might have. But that's it in a nutshell.
Yeah.
You know?
It's just so hard. Nobody wants to do it because who wants to feel their worst feelings, you know?
Yeah. And I think there's a tendency, I don't know about other spiritual movements, but at least in my kind of upbringing in the TM movement, there's a tendency not to emphasize that so much,
yes.
not to put attention on that. It's more like what you put your attention on is going to grow stronger in your life. So you don't want dirt to grow stronger in your life. You know, you want bliss and happiness to grow strong. So always put your attention on the positive. That's going to grow. I'm not sure if that's paid off so well for some people.
Yeah, I think that's like half the picture, the putting your attention on the positive. Because you put your attention on the positive and what you want, and then you just put your attention on whatever else given to you, right? I mean, because that is what is in the way of you getting that usually. And I don't know. It doesn't always make sense to me. It's taken forever to get this to a place where I can even notice what I'm doing all the time and do and. Mm. Because you go through these unconscious emotional habits all the time and don't know it, you know?
Yeah.
And so you have to catch yourself at them.
One thing I find, I mean, I suppose one could take it to either extreme and you have to kind of find a balancing point. Because on the other hand, one could wallow in self-pity or some kind of negative emotion and just really kind of indulge in it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that might not be healthy either. But one thing I find is that emotions have a physical counterpart. And, and maybe this is part of what you've been doing when you're working through stuff. You're not just working through emotions in the abstract, are you? I mean, are you also sort of noticing that there's something in your heart
yeah.
or something in your solar plexus
yeah.
or something in your head or whatever that corresponds to that? And do you kind of put your attention on the physical as part of the process of working through the emotional?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm a very physical person, so I always, it's kind of almost like a given to me that there's something physical correlated with everything.
Yeah.
So I always have attention on those parts that hurt or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of wallowing, I think what it is just keeping in perspective all the time that you desire something and so you're getting there by doing that attention on what could be negative feelings. And they might not be negative feelings. They might be other. Mm-hmm. There's less of them, but I guess there are some people who just want to focus on the negative all the time, and they would have to get out of that too in order to get, because it's like you're just getting into a pattern where you're attached to something, right? And you just have to start feeling everything that's there instead of just that thing that you're in the cycle with.
In other words, don't put conditions on what you're willing to feel. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. And people just, they limit themselves because they're used to, they're more comfortable feeling certain things.
Mm-hmm.
But really, everything is there in all creation. There's every feeling there. And the thing about feelings is that they're underneath the physical and, according to Maharshi, at least right on top of the conscious. You know, it's like consciousness becomes feelings and then becomes physiology.
Uh-huh.
And so they're always there. And when we don't pay attention on them because we're such a materialistic society and everything, then they're getting avoided, and anything that you avoid just comes back.
Stronger.
Yeah, comes back with more force.
Right. You didn't get it the first time? Okay, how about this?
Yeah.
Where do you kind of see yourself going from here? How do you think things are going to unfold for you over the next year or two or three or four?
In terms of just my inward experience, right?
Yeah, mainly that.
I'm just having a lot of experiences of being the center of creation and things coming out of me, going into me.
Mm-hmm.
And actually putting attention to my feelings makes that more intense, which I think is interesting to note because my feelings then will be like going out of myself or things come into me. You know, it's interesting. I just think that I'm just going to keep evolving and whatever that means for me. Like you said before, it's different for everybody. So there's no way of knowing exactly what anybody's going to do or feel or experience, and that's something that's really cool to me because I like the adventure of everything, so I like to not know what's going to happen next, you know.
Yeah.
I like being my own individual. I'm not one of those people who just always didn't want to have a personality and didn't want to be an individual, you know. Mm-hmm. Like, I like being the small self too and everything. And the universe has all these little points in it, and they're like our little small selves, mm-hmm. and they have a certain way of filtering through the information of the universe, mm. or filtering through those qualities of the universe.
In other words, each of us is a filter, and we each filter in different ways.
Yeah.
Or maybe you could say
so we're each like a slightly different
filter. We're each sense organs of the infinite.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that's there's all these popular sayings.
Right. I like that one because, you know, I mean, every single sense organ has its unique way of sensing. If you think of it from a God's perspective or whatever, it's like God's thinking, mm-hmm. all right, I want to have this marvelous, huge experience, and all these individual expressions, all these individual beings are going to be different ways that I'm going to have it, different ways that yeah. I'm going to experience it.
Yeah. You know? I feel it like things come through me hmm. almost. Like I feel that when I'm not blocking hmm. anything. And
like what kind of things?
The more that I evolve, the more
just everything,
comes just through me.
It's like flow sort of.
And a lot of it is feelings because I'm an emotional, you know, person and everything. So there's a lot of just different things coming through my heart center mm-hmm. is how it feels a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it just feels like the more that I grow, the more transparent the small self is, and all these different qualities get expressed in me, but they still are shaped by my personality
right.
a little bit.
And probably always will be.
Yeah.
I would think.
Yeah, because I mean, it's much more fun that way. I mean, yeah. if we were all sitting, walking around being the same person, I mean, that's
yeah,
so boring.
I mean, a lot of people have this awakening experience where they seem to say that they no longer exist as a person. And I'm always tempted to whack them over the head with something and say, well, now do you exist as a person? You know, do you feel that?
Well, I've had a little bit of that happen lately, uh-huh. But it doesn't last for right. me yet. I know that it's a lot of people in their books and such say that that's, and Maharshi said this too, it's a stage, you know, mm-hmm. he would call it Brahman consciousness, and mm-hmm. it's a stage of just really soaking in the universe, and the ego finally is kind of conquered in a sense. That small self isn't trying to grasp things
some
anymore.
People are
that's
horrified.
How I understand it.
Some people are horrified by that notion, though, because they feel that they're going to lose everything that's special and unique about them.
Well, the way that I understand it, now this is not my experience yet, mm-hmm. but the way that I understand it is that it keeps going from there. You don't have a small self for a little while because you have to experience that just like you have to experience uh-huh. all these other things.
So it's just a transitionary phase. Kind
yeah, of. And yeah. then you are again yourself and all of these amazing, huh. huge qualities, you know.
Yeah. I could only speculate myself. I mean, I've never had a situation in which I felt like, and I've read books of people who have this, but I've never had that where I feel like, where am I? You know, I can't identify or locate any sort of sense of individuality.
I have had,
I don't see how you could function if you were that way.
Well, I've had the feeling of that, but not to the point where I couldn't get up. And, like I said, I think it's a change that's happening in me right now mm-hmm. where I'm becoming more and more dominated by the big self instead of the small mm-hmm. self. But it doesn't mean that I'm, like, never going to have an ego or that my ego's not going to try to attach to things or that I don't have a personality
yeah.
or any of those things. It's just that some of the experiences I've had lying down in bed or meditating recently have been a greater emptiness, mm-hmm. like a feeling, a physical feeling of greater emptiness mm. and of light and just lightness, and that my small self isn't as important. And that's played out in the rest of my life in a certain sense. If you want to investigate it, it does play out in your everyday life because you kind of have these lessons, these things happen to you where you're like, do I care about this anymore? Do I want to be attached to this thing anymore? You yeah. know? And you just decide it's not that important anymore.
I think one way of looking at it is if it's working out for you, if your life is improving, you're happier, you feel like you're freer and more fulfilled and everything's getting better in most respects, then you kind of learn to trust the process. Mm-hmm. And if this particular flavor of experience is going to be part of the process, then fine. And next thing you know, it's going to be this one. And next thing you know, it's going to be this one. And you don't kind of get too attached either to, you know, repelling or grasping at any particular phase of the process. You just sort of like, oh, this is interesting, and this is what I'm going through now, and I'll enjoy it while it lasts, and tomorrow it may be gone. And
Yeah, everything changes all the time. That's true. It's not always going to be one way because we would get attached to that.
Yeah.
You know, if it was just one way. And I think the repelling is also a form of attachment. I mean, in the way that I'm meaning attachment, because any time that you're wanting to fit something into a box and say it's just this one thing,
yeah,
or I need this, all of those things are being attached to something, and life will just keep smacking you, smacking you over the head until you just don't care anymore.
Yeah. It's interesting because I'm saying this stuff because I can think of people who have raised objections about the process of gaining enlightenment, or whatever you want to call it, in which they, you know, they'll take some particular aspect of it or aspect of descriptions they've read about it, throw out the baby with the bathwater because they think, well, that particular thing seems kind of creepy to me, even though I haven't experienced yet, but I don't like the sound of it. Therefore, I don't think this is something I want to go for.
Yeah, I did that too.
Did you?
Yeah, I didn't want to be enlightened for a long time because I really think it's our ego senses Brahman as soon as we come in contact with whatever you're reading or listening to, really boring lectures or whatever. Was part of my thing was I didn't want to listen to really boring lectures because I didn't want to become boring. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to lose my personality and I didn't want to... It was my ego fighting becoming big instead of being small, because I think that's interesting because it's like always, it always happens.
Maharishi used to use an analogy. He used to say it's like a man's living in a hut. He's gotten very accustomed to the hut. He starts to venture forth from the hut and he sees there's this palace he can move into. He starts going for the palace and then he thinks, but wait a minute, my hut. You know, and so there's a tendency to want to, I better stay with what I'm comfortable in, you know, my heart.
Yeah.
I'm so used to it, you know, but maybe the palace is cool, but I don't know if I could, you know, too big for
yeah,
me.
Yeah, and that's actually my experience with the whole process is just that you go, I'm in a hut. Kind of like first step is awareness, you know, like I'm in a hut. And then you go out of the hut and you're like, there's something more than this hut, you know? And then you're kind of frustrated because you're like, I'm in a hut. There's something more than the hut, you know?
Right, right.
And then you start to move outside permanently to the palace or whatever. But it's not like the smooth, like you just walk down the road and then you're in the palace, you know? You kind of like move to the palace and then you go back to the hut. And then you move to the palace again and you go back to the hut. And then you're like, maybe I'll go halfway. It's just changing is scary.
Yeah.
You know?
There's even so many stories in the popular culture where people are sort of in some small thing and they take a risk, you know, like Jack and the Beanstalk or whatever. They take a risk to go for something bigger and it's scary to do and everybody tells them they shouldn't. You know, what are you doing? You're crazy? You're giving up these beans or whatever?
Yeah.
however that story went.
Yeah, I really love archetypes and all those stories because I think those stories are things that actually, you know, are metaphors for all of life. You know, they exist on this very deep level for everybody.
Well, I suppose we could babble on all night, but we covered a lot of good stuff. Is there anything that you feel like we haven't covered or that you think when you might get home you might realize, oh yeah, we should have talked about that?
Nothing occurs to me right now. I think the important thing that I would want for people to know is just that it just is a process for me that keeps going, and it just keeps going. I'm not, you know, at this, like enlightenment place or something. For me, is just that I've noticed, and this is just part of my job in life, I think, is to notice when people are avoiding their emotions. Mm-hmm. And just that I got here from confronting my own emotions and just what was there, just confronting my feelings of whatever's there at the time. That was a big deal because in RTM movement, they didn't explain that to me. Maharishi does say something about when you meditate that you should focus on a feeling if you have it, like that you should put attention on a feeling if you have it, but that's the only thing I ever heard, and it really wasn't anything like what I ended up doing because it's a hard process to feel what's there, you know, and to not associate it with your life. It's really hard, and it takes forever to really learn how to do it, you know. It's really helped me a ton, and I wouldn't be here otherwise. I wouldn't be having this interview with you right now.
Well, I'm glad you did it then.
Thanks.
keep doing it.
Thanks.
All righty. Well, we've been talking with Hillary Jordan. My name is Rick Archer, and the show is Buddha at the Gas Pump. We'll be producing a new one of these every week. If you feel like you'd like to be on the show, or if you have any questions or anything, there will be some titles at the end of the show. And I was just working through these with the producer, before we started. And there are a few things we'll put on the titles. There are actually more things than that. There's going to be a podcast and all sorts of things, but it's too much to put in the titles and have anybody copy it all down. So what I think we'll do is there are a couple of the titles you'll see there, like a chat group and a Facebook page perhaps or something or other.
maybe not that, but a chat group, and there's always my email address, and I'll be happy to send you a list of all the different...
Facebook for enlightened people.
Yeah, of all the different things we're developing. On the chat group itself, we'll have links to these various things. Oh, one of the most important things is there's a YouTube channel where all this stuff is being archived. We'll keep adding to that every week. Probably you're watching this on YouTube, a lot of people will be. But in any case, as you can see, this is rather informal. I thank you for watching, and we'll be seeing you next week.